This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio back with me here Craig and Cindy Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey, the activist who was murdered by Israeli soldiers on March 16, 2003, as she was nonviolently trying to protect a Palestinian home from demolition. Craig and Cindy Corey, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
So it's been more than 9 years, actually, the anniversary just passed recently. I'm wondering, you know, how you keep going, actually.
With a lot of support from our friends. I think, you know, Rachel brought us to this particular issue. We were always connected in various ways in our community. We weren't, you know, activists. I would never have called us activists before this. It's been very, very hard work. It's exhausting work at times, but there are also some exhilarating moments. And we see progress on this issue. We feel that we are helping to educate people in this country about why the issue of Israel and Palestine is important to all of us, and that we need to take steps to address it. And you know, wherever we go, I'm heartened by finding people in the smallest places in this country, as well as in places like Madison that have a history of being progressive, who care deeply, who know Rachel's story, or when they learn about it, are touched by it, and who give energy to us by their interest and by then oftentimes by their decisions to act as well in some way.
You know, Matt, Rachel was killed a little more than 9 years ago. But one of the things she gave us is the family that was behind the wall that Rachel stood in front of. So we know those children. We know the parents of that family. And they're growing up. And so when I think sometimes of this, you know, how do you take another step? Of course, they don't have a choice, for one thing. And also there's great joy in that because, for instance, Rachel helped the oldest boy with his English homework, and he would help her learn her Arabic. And when we were there in 2009, that boy had grown up and going to college, and he came home and he announced that he had just switched his major to English. And I'm going, yeah, you know, that's really neat. So that's part of it, is that there are a lot of other people that are taking another step. And some, if it's a hard day, you know, I think, well, if one of those people can take another step, so can I.
And you've had the support of the other children in your family, I take it, from this?
We have two other children who are older than Rachel. Her sister, Sarah, 5 years older. Her brother, Chris, 7 years older. And I think one of the things that was really important, and it took a while. Of course, we were just, at the time Rachel was killed, just taking the next step, moment to moment.
But just getting out of bed had to be hard.
Yeah, or going to sleep or whatever, yeah. You know. I mean, I kind of in my gut remember how I felt at that time, but I remember when color kind of returned in my life, and I'm grateful that I can't, even though I have a memory of it, I don't feel, you know, that way. I feel like I've recovered in some way, and so but for our family and for our kids, it was very important to respect all of our individual differences about what we were able to do, what we chose to do. And so we've tried very hard to do that. Our daughter Sarah is very involved in the lawsuit that we have in Israel and in the work of that. But my son has two children. I have two grandchildren and his family to care for. And he said, I remember him saying there was a moment where he thought he should just drop everything and turn totally to working on this issue, but then realized that really wasn't realistic in his situation. But they're very supportive and loving, and of course, that's, we go to visit the grandchildren for rest and recreation.
Cindy, you mentioned the trial. Craig, why don't you bring us up to date? Tell us about the trial, who you're suing, why you're suing, what's going on?
Well, to sort of go way back to the beginning, the day after Rachel was killed, Prime Minister Sharon was on the phone with President Bush, and he promised President Bush a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation. And that has not happened. And that's not just my opinion, but it's been a written statement by the State Department about a year later after Rachel was killed. Colin Powell's chief of staff put that into writing, and it's been reiterated and still the position as stated by some individuals in the White House. So, Mr. Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff, then suggested you can sue them. What he said in our first meeting in the State Department is he turned to me in a conversation. He said, you know, if it were my daughter, I wouldn't care about money or anything. I'd sue him. And
he's an interesting person, isn't he?
He certainly is. And he's become a bit of a hero of mine since he got out. And that's a whole different program in some ways.
This is when he was critical of the Bush administration, of Cheney especially, right?
Yeah. And actually, we met, my daughter Sarah and I met with him in December 2004, so he knew he was leaving office there. And we had like an hour and a half or two-hour meeting with him, and I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. You know, his boss is giving the speeches. This is a guy that's running the show for the U.S. State Department. Why is he spending all this time with us? And so I sort of finally said, you know, you got other things to do or something. But left. He gave us all that time, and now I know he had to be just depressed, and we were a real family with real issues sitting in his office because he sort of just wanted to keep on talking. And he has done a lot of good now in the country. I heard him on TV or the radio a few months ago saying, you know, I wish I had resigned. And I thought, if you had resigned at the time you were talking about, so instead of going into the Iraq war in protest, we would have never met him. And he is the person that started a lot of things in motion for us, including this lawsuit, to come back to that topic. So he sort of suggested it, and we weren't thinking about that at the time. But at any rate, when 2 years came up, you had a statute of limitations of 2 years. There had been no thorough, credible, and transparent investigation. And the only avenue we have as a family that we can control to push something forward is a civil lawsuit. So it is a civil lawsuit. It's not criminal. You can't control that. And in fact, they wouldn't do a criminal case because there had been an investigation by the military, and while we don't think that's thorough, credible, or transparent, that was enough to keep that out of any sort of criminal trial. So we brought the lawsuit. It's against the government of Israel. It's not against, and the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, is not against any individual. Our real reason for doing that is because we could then have some sort of process to ask questions and try to get more information that had not been forthcoming from the Israeli government. So, you know, one of my messages that I go back and say in the State Department and elsewhere is it is difficult for a citizen, a father, to try and enforce the promise of one head of state to another. You know, I really, the State Department, our government has been helpful. There have been two people present at the trial every time that it's been in session, so from the U.S. Embassy. So in ways like that, they've helped us as a parent, but they're not enforcing that promise from a head of state to President Bush.
I'm speaking with Craig and Cindy Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey, the activist, international solidarity activist, who was murdered by an Israeli soldier driving a Caterpillar
D9R bulldozer.
Bulldozer, yeah, mm-hmm. While she was nonviolently sitting in front of a home that was about to be demolished in an act of nonviolent civil disobedience. Tell us how the trial's gone. What was surprising to you in the trial, Cindy?
The first court date was March 10th, 2010, and it began with witnesses, with our side of the case. We had a fairly small number. We brought four of the seven internationals who had witnessed Rachel's killing. She was there with other members of the international solidarity movement, and they were all there on the ground that day. We brought a couple of other witnesses. And then the state began their case, and they called actually many of their military witnesses. I'm forgetting the actual number now, but I think we've had something like 22 or 23 testimonies. But the last day in court for oral testimony was on July 10th, 2011. So over a year of oral testimony, we would have, you know, sometimes several sessions at a time, and then there would be a break of some months, and we would have to come back for more sessions. The system is very different, I think, for people that know anything about U.S. courts. Of course, there's some similarities when you're in a courtroom, but the process is different. There are no juries. It's heard by a single judge. There are no juries in any court proceedings in Israel. And so the judge, so the judge is hearing the entire case. It's in Haifa District Court. This is the court in Israel that's immediately below the Supreme Court there. There is a lower court, the magistrates' courts as well. It's a very, I've been on two juries in the United States, in Olympia, Washington. I think probably our courts vary from district to district. But it was eye-opening to me when we got in there. And in fact, our attorney took some of the eyewitnesses, I think, the day or two before into another courtroom just so they could see one and to hear a little bit about how things proceeded. But generally, I find that the whole environment is much more volatile than what I'm used to in U.S. courts.
Volatile? How? Why?
Well, there's a decorum in at least where I've been in U.S. courts where there's great respect for the judge. People, you know, if you disagree with a judge, you might say, "With all due respect, sir," and then say how you disagree with him. There's yelling and,
they try to overtalk like I'm doing now, you know, and they just keep talking back and forth.
Sometimes it's hilarious. You know, there are hilarious moments, which I'm glad, you know, that we can bring levity to something that's so serious at times. But it goes both ways. The judge will be very volatile and yell at the attorneys and at the people in the courtroom. One thing, so people get a sense, it's all in Hebrew. Hebrew, of course, except for our international witnesses who spoke English and had to have translation. So for Craig and I and our daughter Sarah to understand everything, we have to have translators sitting next to us in court. Also, there have been observers. We've encouraged people to come, and there have been observers from human rights organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Advocates Sans Frontières, which is a legal organization, and then other of the Israeli and even Palestinian human rights organizations. Al Haq from the West Bank, Bet Selem had an observer there recently. That's an Israeli human rights organization. Yesh Din, which looks at investigations, it's an Israeli organization.
Have you had support from rabbis for human rights?
Very much.
One came and showed up in court. In fact, we'd been in contact and talked to him on the telephone. He's from the United States, but we hadn't met him before.
Well, that's
the
Eric
guy
Asherman,
was sitting in court. Yeah.
Actually, Eric Asherman is a friend of ours, but a rabbi, Craig's thinking of another one. There were actually two times that people from Rabbis for Human Rights were there, but there's a rabbi in Haifa, a woman who came to one of the more recent court sessions.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah.
I'm sitting with Cindy and Craig Corey, parents of Rachel Corey, who are currently suing the State of Israel in a wrongful death suit over Rachel's murder back in 2003. Craig, in preparing for this interview, I read that you all thought that the Israeli government or the IDF was withholding evidence. Why did you think that, and did they cough up the evidence?
Well, it's kind of amazing, actually. There's a video that the Israeli military had a camera on the border with Egypt, and so that was a few hundred meters away from where this happened. And they released a short tape to the U.S. government and also to media outlets. So it right after Rachel was killed, it was on Israeli TV, and it's been in some films. It's been in our State Department was allowed to see it, and in fact, we've gotten a copy of it. That film, which included the radio transmissions that on a particular frequency, so you could hear some talking, which of course was in Hebrew mostly, and it showed the bulldozers and there were two bulldozers that day, and you couldn't see this from the film, but each of which had two people in it. And then there was an armored personnel carrier, which is kind of like a tank, but it doesn't have a turret. So they were pushing dirt towards the houses. You can see that. And then the camera kind of looks around at some house windows and stuff, which all seems kind of reasonable. I'm a was in the Army in Vietnam, and then it stares at the ground for about half a minute, and then it swings and looks at Egypt, and it's more like a traffic cam in Egypt. You know, it's just looking at some stuff of people moving, but it's pretty bizarre for about 4.5 minutes. And then you hear over the radio, "I think I've hit something," or somebody, depending on how it's translated. And so then it swings back and starts looking at the bulldozers and stuff that's going on. So and it goes on another 5 minutes in that original thing that came out. So it's about 12 minutes in total. What we know now and what we learned in the ensuing 9 years after that came out is that the bulldozers and the armored personnel carrier had called in, now we know it was by cell phone rather than on the radio frequencies you can hear, and asked for orders to leave the area, and they were told to go back in. So that's the 5 minutes when the camera turns away is between when they got the orders to go back in and when Rachel was killed. Now, when we got to court, what they submitted to the court was about 12 minutes of tape as well, but it starts at the moment you hear that, "I think I've hit something." So it doesn't show the bulldozers operating beforehand, and you don't see, they just say, well, the camera looks at different things. And they say in court, no other film exists, that it's only being taped when somebody pushes on a button and decides to tape something. Now, we kept trying to say, there's more tape, hand over the other tape. It never happened in court. Now, their 12 minutes goes a little bit longer, so one of the really interesting things to me is that in a briefing that was given to our government and copies, it's a PowerPoint presentation, and we've seen it on paper, so printouts, they've taken one little slice, one still picture out of this film and said, and in it, it's all very blurry. It's very difficult to say. It has a little arrow and you can't see anything. It says, this is where Rachel is. And you can see the bulldozer, and it says, see the bulldozer, there's a mound of earth. Rachel's on the other side of the mound of earth. She couldn't be seen. Well, we knew from the pictures we'd seen and stuff, that's not the bulldozer that ran over Rachel. That's not where Rachel's body was, and that's not the directions the bulldozer were going when they were pushing the earth. If you've got the minutes that we saw in front of the court, you can see the people come to pick up Rachel, you know, and they go right past that spot and go with their stretcher and pick her up from a place that's very far, much farther out. So what we know now is that they were lying to our government right from the beginning rather than a thorough investigation.
When are you expecting a verdict in this case?
The verdict was scheduled by the judge for April 23rd. This was last year when we were last in court in July. And we're now in the summation phase of the case. And again, it's different from U.S. courts, where if people watched old Perry Mason or even excerpts from what goes on now in court, at the end of a trial, the attorneys get up and they each do their summations and so forth, and then the jury goes and decides. In Israeli court, our side had 3 months to write our summation of all the evidence that was heard according to the laws that we wanted to apply and so forth. Our attorneys did that and turned it in November. The state had 3 months to reply to what we had written, and they were to turn in their part at the end of February. And the judge then had said, according to that schedule, we'd have a verdict on April 23rd. Instead, the state, at the end of February, asked for an additional 30 days. Our attorney then, he does, according to the schedule, have 2 weeks to reply to whatever they write. He has now, I think, asked for an additional 2 weeks as well, since they asked for that additional time. So we don't know when that verdict will be, but clearly it doesn't seem possible before May, June, or July, and it could even be beyond. The judge, of course, is hearing other cases at the same time, dealing with other matters. He pointed out in the court, and I had to say that I felt this was reasonable. When our attorney would try to maybe encourage some scheduling consideration because of the fact that our family is traveling all the way from the United States, he pointed out that there's no consideration in Israeli courts for people coming from other places, and also that he had people sitting in jail who were waiting, you know, nothing had proceeded on their cases, and they were sitting there just waiting. And of course, I'm sympathetic to those people sitting in jail too. So That's the situation right now, as we're waiting to hear the verdict date.
I'm speaking with Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Craig, I was at the website rachelcoreyfoundation.org, and I saw a statement by you where you said how inadequate accountability is, even if you succeed in this case. And I wanted you to expound on that a little bit.
Well, you know, whatever we do, we can't bring Rachel back. So I think early on after she was killed, a new friend gave me some books from South Africa by Desmond Tutu. And so you look at Western legal process and our punitive justice. And so somehow to balance the scales of justice, when one person is hurt, we go and hurt the other person. And it's just kind of cumulative hurt. And where there, you know, their process would be that you figure out what happened, you have an investigation, and then each side has to admit that they have some role that they played in what happened. And then, then Desmond Tutu says you have to forgive. Now, I have to read that one more slowly. I'm not sure, and I've talked to some other people, because one friend said, whose daughter was killed in South Africa, that she couldn't, you know, it's not okay. It's not okay. Now, this happens to be Linda Beale. Amy, her daughter, was killed there. And Linda Beale has a foundation, and Cindy's seen her on TV with one of the people that killed her daughter talking, both of them giving a speech. So she says, I've come to learn how this happened, but it's not okay. And so anyway, there's a process that if you sort of mend the fabric of society that's torn by some act of violence, but
that would be hard for me, I got to say.
Yeah, but the process, a legal process like we have in the West, it continues to tear that fabric. And, you know, you go through here, it's adversarial, and the attorneys will try to pretend, well, this is all my job, but it's not a really nice job, I guess is a charitable way to say it.
And so the trial's going to end sometime, looks like early summer of 2012 here. And then what do you see yourselves doing?
Well, the trial is one piece of what we do now. And there's a lot of work to be done with it. I think there's a lot of education to do around it. We have over 2,000 pages of transcript material, and there are some pretty stunning things. I mean, there's a lot of long, boring, I think, pieces as well, but there's some pretty stunning information. You asked earlier about the some of the things that we had learned, and the lead investigator, the person who was to conduct the investigation that President Bush was told would be thorough, credible, and transparent, testified under oath that he believed that they were at war with everyone in Gaza, including the peace activists. So hardly somebody who came at this in an impartial way. When he testified, he never got inside a D9 bulldozer. He said he looked at the bulldozer was to see if there was any blood on it. Because when you think about, well, why was that the one thing he was looking for? He was looking for, I believe, information that would try to say that the bulldozer wasn't responsible. That there are still at the highest levels, the highest military person who testified still testified that he believed the bulldozer really hadn't gone over Rachel, even though soldiers on the ground have now said that, yes, of course, her body was where we've seen it in the photographs, and that the company commander, who was the highest ranking person on the ground, said, yes, he knew within a minute when he came and saw there that that's what had occurred. But when Craig mentioned this photo evidence earlier, in which they were trying to say Rachel was behind this mound of earth, she couldn't be seen, et cetera, and that at first that the bulldozer never touched her, it was part of, I think, of a story really to the U.S. government, and that continues. So we've learned a lot of things that we need to try to put together in a way that we can share with people, that we can also take back to the U.S. government.
And probably a story to the U.S. public, too.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm speaking with Craig and Cindy Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey. Craig, you and Cindy are involved in the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement too, correct?
Yeah, and actually that was kind of a struggle for me to come to that in a sense. But boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So first of all, trying to boycott goods that come from Israel or some places it's just the goods that maybe come from settlements that are illegal settlements in the West Bank. And it's a nonviolent method of trying to isolate Israel until they recognize the rights of the Palestinian people. So it's not trying to hurt Israel. It's trying to change behavior, just like it was used in South Africa. And then, of course, divestment. People are invested. For instance, if you've got investment in Caterpillar, and Caterpillar knowingly supplies the bulldozers that not only ran over Rachel but destroy homes and crops and stuff there, then you're profiting from this. And so a lot of people, you know, would prefer to make their money in ways that don't destroy other people's livelihoods and homes. And so just not doing that. And of course, sanctions is a government sort of thing. So as one friend says, if it comes to sanctions, then you sort of already won. That's not quite true, because some of the sanctions are working in Europe with other governments. So it's a strong way to say, you know, to Israel, we want you to change your behavior. We want you to recognize the human rights of all the people in the area. And I've got to say that, you know, there is a part of it that I think has some harm to innocent people, because there's certainly a lot of Israelis that, well, there are a lot of Israeli friends that we have that have helped us, although they're saying, you got to do this. Mm-hmm. You have to help. You have to come from the outside and help this, and this is the way to do it. But I've, you know, Cindy and I have pretty much tried everything else. And so, you know, you're down to this, and it's working. The word is getting out, you know, and I think it's moving forward.
We have an effort in Olympia, a BDS. We have Olympia BDS, a new organization. It's actually been around now, I guess, for over a year or two. But we... We're actually surprised. Craig and I were in Israel when a group of people in our community brought a resolution to the Olympia Food Co-op to take Israeli products off the shelves. I forget the number, but there were maybe 5 to 7 products. They followed all of their rules, and the board of directors was very supportive, and they implemented that boycott. After that, there was some opposition and quite a lot of discussion. Some of it, I think, very difficult. I wasn't there for it in our community. The thing I was talking to a group of Israeli women activists at the time this happened. And I, told them, I said, I don't know how you'll feel about this. And one woman leapt in the air and she said, I'm for it. And when I talked to the others and I said that what I'd heard is it had opened up the discussion again in our community in a way that had not happened since Rachel was killed in 2003. And people there in Israel were listening to that and thinking that's important because they want us to engage with this issue. There has been a lawsuit against the people that brought the co-op, the resolution forward, but it was dismissed recently. So we're very happy about that.
That's Cindy Corey. I've been talking with Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey. I'm Matt Rothschild. You've been listening to Progressive Radio. You can find out more at rachelcoreyfoundation.org about the work that they're doing and the lawsuit that we've been talking about. Craig and Cindy Corey, thanks again for being my guests here on Progressive Radio.
It's our pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.